Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show, hosted by author, investor, money partner, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris, equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, I'm Bruce Norris, and thank you for joining us. Today, again, we're joined with by Paul Leonard, the director of the California office, the Center of Responsible Lending. Paul, thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure. Happy to be here again.
Martin, I believe his last name is Eakes or Eakes?
Eakes,
okay. The CEO of both the Center of Responsible Lending and the Center for Community Self-Help said in a testimony in front of Congress just this year in February, "The risk posed by these subprime loans are magnified because they are designed to create refinances." It sort of sounds like subprime mortgages have a built-in obsolescence. How has that been costly for the home buyer or person who refis multiple times?
Well, we talked about last time, the basic product is a product that has a discounted rate for 2 years, and then has a payment shock in month 25, and we think that loan does really it serves to act as a sort of a balloon loan, a 2 year balloon loan, at which point people either are forced to refinance, or in a declining housing market, they are likely to have to default and potentially foreclose. But the costs of refinance are substantial. First of all, about 70% of subprime loans have prepayment penalties with them that are going, and in California, it's particularly severe because it's tied to the interest rates on the loan. So they're going to have to pay 6 months of interest as a prepayment penalty. That comes out of the equity of homeowners who are trying to use their home ownership to build wealth. And repeated refinances result in transaction costs and refinancing costs of anywhere from 3%, 4%, 5% of the amount of the loan. That is money that is flowing as a sort of a transfer of wealth from borrowers who are trying to generate equity into the hands of the lending industry.
Okay, now we're talking about a subject that's entitled subprime loans. What makes a person a subprime borrower?
Well, there are a range of definitions, but usually it's a credit score that is below 650 or 660 is usually sort of the definition. Most broadly, subprime borrowers are borrowers who have some kind of a credit blemish or a credit. They don't have a perfect credit score.
Okay. Shouldn't there be some sort of premium allowed to the lender that's willing to make that loan?
Absolutely. And we have, we don't have any concerns and feel like having risk-based pricing that appropriately accounts for the risks that are incurred by the lenders is a critical way for borrowers who have imperfect credit to get into home ownership. It's a really important thing, but that risk should be reflected in an interest rate, and the loans should be underwritten so that the borrowers have a reasonably decent chance to be able to repay the loan over the life of the loan, based on their income and not required appreciation of the underlying house asset.
What form do you think would be acceptable as far as the premium that probably the lending world would say, okay, we can live with that, and what you would want?
Again, I think it's more a question of the. We would like to see most of those adjustments reflected in the interest rate. But what happens is that the lending world incorporates a range of other features like stated incomes and prepayment penalties and yield spread premiums, which serve to heighten the risks associated with loans that go to subprime borrowers.
Just to review, in case somebody didn't join us last time, the yield spread premium, that seems to be a very significant thing. And it's one of the main bonuses and maybe why lenders steer people to subprime. So could you just describe that yield spread premium one more time?
Sure. A yield spread premium is really essentially a kickback that goes from the lender to the broker for bringing in a loan at a higher interest rate than the best rate for which the borrower qualifies.
Okay.
Now, that's it can be a point or two, and it's working against the interests of the borrower who have an interest in having a lower rate.
Now, does this really show its ugly face month 25 when we have it adjust to the payment it's going to end up? Does this risk spread premium is the game that they play? Is it really felt on month 25 or month or day one?
Oh, it's felt on day one.
Okay.
I mean, the yield spread premium affects the initial interest rate. The terms of the adjustment at month 25 are usually they revert back to one of the common interest indexes, and then they add on a margin. And for subprime borrowers, the margin that they add on to one of these indexes is usually somewhere between 5 and 7 percentage points, which that margin alone is often higher than the initial interest rate.
So you're telling me that if I get a loan that starts out at 6%, on month 25, my interest rate could actually nearly double on one shot?
Well, it is possible, although what happens in most cases is that there are limits on the amount of an increase at any given point in time. But unlike prime loans, subprime loans will adjust every 6 months, so that theoretically, your interest rate would go up a full 6 percentage points, but many loans have a limit that only allows it to go up by 2 or sometimes 3 percentage points.
Okay.
So, but what will happen is that within a year or at the outside 2 years of every 6 months, the interest rate will step up until it reaches that maximum rate.
And it sounds like on a subprime loan, it goes a lot quicker to get there.
It does go a lot quicker. And again, most subprime loans are adjusting in month 25 after 2 years, rather than the much more common prime loans of 3 years or more commonly 5 years.
Do you think there'll be some kind of cascade effect if the subprime mortgage world, in fact, has a very outrageous number of foreclosures? Will it start affecting the Alt-A and prime loans that have adjustables because the equity just won't be there for them as well?
Well, you know, I think that there's going to be some sort of feedback loop here. Wall Street is buying and is looking very carefully at what's happening in the subprime market, and I think that there's going to be more scrutiny, particularly here in California, where the housing prices are so high that many Alt-A and prime borrowers have used adjustable rates to stretch beyond what they could otherwise afford to be able to get into their home ownership situations.
Absolutely. May 31, 2006, the Center for Responsible Lending produced a report entitled Unfair Lending, the Effect of Race and Ethnicity. Boy, I've had trouble with that one. And on the prime price of subprime mortgages.
Yes.
I can seem to recall in the past years that there was something called redlining that steered people actually away from getting a chance to own a home. And can you describe if that practice has sort of taken on a new face in this last housing boom?
Absolutely. In the last 10 years, the nature of the challenge facing low-income and particularly minority households has changed dramatically. 10, maybe 15 years ago, as you described it, the main challenge was redlining, was simply when applying for a loan, getting the answer to be yes. That there were the term redlining comes from the idea that there were geographic neighborhoods and areas, high minority populations, where lenders would simply draw a red line and say, we're not going to make loans in those communities. Right. What's happened in the last 10 years with the advent of automated underwriting and credit scoring, and most importantly with risk-based pricing, the question facing minority borrowers is no longer whether or not you're going to get a loan. The question is, what are the terms of that loan going to be, and how much more are minority borrowers going to pay for loans than for white households?
There's a couple of groups. One's the Consumer Mortgage Coalition and Coalition for Fair and Affordable Lending Groups. They lobbied against the implementation of the new loan guidance as it has to do with subprime loans. And that stance seems to fly in the face of the group's stated intended purpose. Why would they choose to be opposed to increased consumer protection?
Well, despite their names, their noble sounding names, these are really industry groups, and the industry has been very, very resistant and reluctant to put an end to the practices which have been incredibly profitable for them, but at the price of really high foreclosures and loss of wealth for lots and lots of low-income borrowers for whom their home purchase is their chance to really advance economically in our society.
So they're almost championing the cause of the person that's getting the commission rather than the person that's buying the property. Is that sort of true?
Absolutely. I mean, over the last few years, the subprime mortgage game has been a volume game. And the goal is to get as much volume, make as many loans as you can, get those loans made, sell them off into the secondary markets, into Wall Street, and not have to bear the consequences for how well those loans perform down the road. Wall Street can account for much of that risk by very sophisticated financial practices in the securitization world and over-collateralizing the securities that they're selling. What it means is that the borrowers are the ones who are bearing the bulk of the risks of those loans.
Okay. One of the assertions by these groups was that if the guidance were extended to the 228 mortgages, that many first-time buyers would lose the opportunity to own a home. Are they correct that true?
There will clearly be some first-time buyers who will not be able to own a home. But I don't think we're doing first-time home buyers any great service by putting them into a loan that they can't afford to pay over the long term. And what we've been doing over the last few years with housing price appreciation only going upward, we've created an impression that home ownership is a guaranteed pathway to wealth accumulation. But as the housing price appreciation has slowed down, we can no longer continue to make, and we should never have been making loans based on the bet purely of housing price appreciation. We believe that people should be qualified for loans based on their ability to repay them out of their income, not purely betting on housing price appreciation.
Okay. The chief executive officer of KB Homes, Jeffrey Metzger, he stated this in a newspaper just a couple days ago. If subprime tightens up and underwriting tightens up, it's going to impact demand. Do you agree with that assessment that home builders will be negatively impacted?
Well, you know, first of all, still at least half, and in some cases historically closer to two-thirds of the subprime market has been refinance market rather than a purchase market. Here, California, it's closer to half because prices are so high. Whether or not subprime lending is now roughly somewhere between 20 and 25% of all market volume over the last couple of years, will there be some decline at the margin? Yes, but I think that is a certainly a prudent decline for loans that are being made today that are only going to put people on the path towards foreclosure and not towards wealth accumulation.
I absolutely agree. Do you think that the new guidance that's probably going to be implemented will ultimately end up having the nation have a recession?
I don't think that the guidance itself will result in pushing the market towards a recession. And I think one of the things that's interesting to note is that the levels of defaults and the higher levels of foreclosures that have occurred, by and large, in many places in the country, have happened while the economy is still performing very strongly, while employment rates are overall very high. Now, clearly, there have been selected geographic regions of the country where we've seen increases in unemployment that have led to higher levels of defaults and foreclosures. But in California, we've seen sharp increases in foreclosures without any corresponding increases in the employment base.
And that's been pretty much a one-year phenomenon so far.
That's correct.
Historically, we have a pretty long run-up of foreclosures when we head in that direction. So if we go down the road, say, another 4 years with a multiple effect, I can't imagine that not impacting employment. I would think that's a no-brainer.
Well, I think that, you know, there is certainly, it's easy to spin out the path to where the real estate declines lead to larger economic impacts in the economy. And you know, in the last few weeks, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board has been asked about this. He has indicated he doesn't believe it's going to happen, but there's certainly there's a risk there. And if the housing market decline continues over a substantial period of time, if foreclosures are as great as we are projecting, clearly there could be larger economic impacts.
The map that is in the report really doesn't show for any safe haven areas. California is one of three states with 21% to 24% projected, but most of the rest of the country has a projection in the teens.
That's correct. Again, I mean, the foreclosure rates that we are projecting in the subprime market are historically high levels, and they are broadly disseminated across the entire country. It sort of focused on the fact that we've had historically strong housing markets over the first number of years of this decade, and with those housing markets cooling and with housing price appreciation slowing down substantially, you do see significant levels of foreclosures in the subprime market spread out all across the country. Clearly, those efforts are concentrated in the markets where there has been the greatest run-ups, and that's particularly true here in California, in New York, and some East Coast markets, and in the state of Florida, where the changes in the housing price appreciation are projected to be most significant.
When you have an area, let's say like Ohio, which really has had a pretty tough time of it for a while, mm-hmm. with foreclosures, what are the impacts to society in an area where people are literally getting poorer instead of getting a chance to gain wealth?
Well, again, in Ohio and in Michigan, where you've also had high levels of foreclosures, a lot of that is driven by the decline in the economic base there. And so there's a rippling effect, and clearly there is a lot of loss, a lot of wealth being lost at all levels, felt most acutely at lower income levels.
There's a recent ad I heard on the radio where a lawyer is saying, if you have an adjustable mortgage and it has turned into a monster, we can probably help you. Do you see lawyers having a field day representing borrowers who perhaps were unaware what they were getting into?
Well, there are some interesting cases pending now, and I think time will tell as those cases play out through the court system. It's possible that lawyers will be able to help you. I think the most important thing for borrowers right now is to really go back and review what their mortgage documents are. What are the changes that they're going to be able to, the payment adjustments that are going to happen down the road? The terms of those adjustments should be laid out in the mortgage documents, and they can then prepare for and plan for the changes that they may likely to be facing.
I'm sure the lenders will be watching those cases with interest, because that'll set a precedent for what the future might hold for them.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the reality is that our nation's laws about disclosure have not kept pace with the changing instruments in the mortgage market, with option arms and adjustable rate mortgages. When one looks at the disclosure requirements, they're really that we're geared more towards a mortgage environment in which we're dealing primarily with fixed rate mortgages. So that the disclosure requirements are not as clear as they should be for informing consumers about what's going to happen in the future with their either payment option arms or with adjustable rate mortgages, particularly, you know, for in the subprime market where the adjustments are happening every 6 months after month 25.
Let me ask you, there's a lot of stated income loans that probably the information wasn't correct to begin with. Do you feel mm-hmm. the same level of empathy with a borrower who falsified his or her income to obtain the loan?
Well, you know, again, I've talked to a lot of housing counseling agencies and others who have dealt with who deal directly with lots and lots of borrowers in cases of stated income loans. And in many cases, the borrowers are really not aware of what's actually of the documents that they're signing and what's included in those documents. And many people are quick to blame the customer for, you know, not reading their documents very carefully. But I would certainly challenge most to ask people, my friends and colleagues who I deal with, if they've read all of the materials in their closing of their mortgages. And to a person, virtually none of them have read all of those documents.
No, the stack is rather high.
Right.
And so,
I mean, what's needed is really simple, clear disclosure information that allows the borrower to sort of wade through the morass of documents that they have to sign at the closing table, that lays out in plain English and in clear and simple terms the nature of the mortgage and the terms in which it's going to be adjusting over time. That's without a doubt, it seems to me, just a fundamental basic, and it's remarkable to me that the industry hasn't been more forthcoming with that clear, plain English disclosure regime.
I gather by your comments that you feel that quite often perhaps the lender has been maybe the one that's dictated the necessary stated income and its magic.
Either the lender or the broker is often simply putting down what the numbers that they need to in order to close the loan. And in some cases, the amount of the income may be relatively small. In other cases, it may be quite large. The Mortgage Asset Research Institute has done some studies, sort of some simple surveys, and found that the vast proportion, about 60% of a sample of mortgages that they stated income mortgages they looked at, were off by a margin of 90% in the amount of actual income that the families had.
I read that.
That is a serious problem. And having much more responsible verification of income is really critical to getting to cleaning up what's happening in the subprime mortgage market today.
One of the goals for the Center of Responsible Lending is to make permanent changes in the protection of the consumer. Do you see that protection coming from a state or federal level, and which one of them would have the bigger teeth? In other words, what one would make more of an impact?
Well, we think that the best way of doing that would have we think it's due time for federal reform of mortgage activity. The federal law, the HOPA law, hasn't been that is dealing with predatory lending hasn't been addressed in a very long time. We believe there should be very firm, strong federal standards that include, at a minimum, a standard that requires the lender to assess the borrower a reasonable ability to repay based on income alone. Beyond the statutory and regulatory framework, however, I think that there's really an important role to figure out if we can create some kind of a network that would give borrowers an opportunity to easily contact what we call trusted advisors, that who have no stake in the outcome of the loan, but who could give consumers, any consumers, say through an 800 number, an opportunity to review with somebody who is very familiar with the mortgage industry whether or not the loan that they've gotten is one that makes sense for them.
One last question. When you tighten the guidance for new loans going forward, mm-hmm. you also tighten it for people trying to get out of the bad loan they already have.
Yes.
You see that having a pretty negative impact for the next 2 years. We got about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I think that clearly tightening the standards will have some negative impacts for borrowers who are in loans they should never have been in the first place. And I think as a matter of public policy, we need to think really hard about how we can make available some kind of a rescue product that will allow many of those borrowers to avoid the disaster of foreclosure.
Paul, that's a great way to end our discussion. I want to thank you so much for joining us the past 2 weeks. I think we've done a valuable service for the people that will be listening, and I look forward to going over some of these ideas where the bailout of the people in the loans they can't get out of, that would be implemented. So thanks again for joining us, Paul.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or email questions and or comments to radio@thenorrisgroup.com. We'll see you next week at 5:30 here on News Talk 590 KTIE.